Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Season's greetings, man.
Oh, yeah. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa. Whatever you celebrate.
Happy nothing, also.
We're glad to have you. A lot of people just binge this podcast and listen to all the episodes at once, you know, on like a long road trip. So this could be somebody listening in July right now.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, making snow angels and Kris Kringle and crap.
They'll never know the holiday ennui you and I are feeling at the moment.
Yeah.
So that's either months in the past or months in the future for them.
Right. Here for us, it's the impending present.
Yeah. I pretty much have holiday ennui the entire year through. You know what I need? Is I need a war on ennui.
Yeah.
That's the war on Christmas adjacent conflict that I'm into.
Well, I think that when people say, have a nice day, that's sort of the implication is that they're part of the war on ennui. It's the happy holidays of the war on ennui.
Yeah. Yeah, truly.
Have you ever heard that thing? Like, I think have a nice day, like, didn't exist before the 80s.
Really?
Have you heard this? Like, that this is like a very vaguely recollected thing, but I was like poking around somewhere on the internet and I stumbled across some like stand-up comedy thing where it was about how a bunch of stand-ups in the 80s had chunks in their sets about how have a nice day was something people say now and how weird that is. Like the, you know, because like the penchant of a stand-up comic is to react negatively against a neologism of any kind.
You know, I have a theory about this.
Uh-huh.
And that is, back to my very first retail jobs, that was a sort of comment that was legislated into your behavior. Like, you were graded customer service-wise on if you gave a greeting. Like, I'm trying to remember these off the top of my head. This is 20 years ago, but like, greet the customer with a smile. Uh-huh. Ask them if they need any help. Take them directly to the thing that they are asking about. Like, if they're asking you where the fucking pickles are, you take them to the pickles. You don't just point. You thank them for coming in at the end, and you tell them to have a nice day. Like, there's a list of things. And we were encouraged to model that behavior because we were secretly shopped by people who would then grade us. And then our managers would get reports
right.
That would say stuff like, you know, Adam did 3 out of the 5 things. The 2 things he didn't do was greet with a smile because he's not a monster.
Yeah.
And and he said some variation of have a nice day that wasn't exactly have a nice day. It was something like have a good one.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think
keep on trucking, I think, was your common salutation.
One of the monstrous things that has happened to managerial authority in all types of workplace is the skewing towards things that can only be measured.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're taking subjectivity out of a manager's arsenal and making them just like check boxes about employees instead of looking at employees like real people. They are automatons that either do or do not greet with a smile or say have a nice day at the end.
The entirely quantified managerial style is so much a product of these like huge companies that are trying to have an extremely consistent experience
right.
from place to place. But it's also like one of those things that becomes a cudgel wielded by extremely literal minded managers who
right.
just who
if
like,
you're not a good manager, you fucking love this.
Yeah.
If you're not a good people person, this is a thing for you.
I say have a nice day to people when I'm a customer in line at a thing. Like when I'm checking out at the grocery store, I say it. But it really did become like a... I'm looking at there's a Wikipedia article about it. And it is like the 70s that it became part of common parlance. And like it has like a weird countercultural association. Like hippies used to say like happy day and then it like became have a good day, and then like St. Patrick's Day marches, there was like a black banner that said POWMIA families never have a nice day, which is like
wow. Really,
like I feel like we should have like a friendly fire special episode about this, because I bet John remembers when people started saying it.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
this is a... Like this kind of programming, the social programming, especially in retail, is something that I really struggle against as a customer, because this is going to feel very closely tied to the never do bits on tips philosophy that you and I have as sort of a governing philosophy with being a good person out
right.
in the world. But like, break the script
right.
is what I would encourage anyone out there to do. Like you're entering into a contract socially when you step up to the register with your groceries on the belt that doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
And you can break it, and it's more fun to break it. And here's the thing, like here's what's fucked up. You're the only one with permission to do that, the customer.
Right.
So do it. You are saving a retail employee's life in that 2 minutes, if you can shoot the shit with them like a real person and just get off script.
Just treat them as a peer. Like,
yeah,
like
that's not, all it takes.
Just be nice to them and ask them how their day's going.
December is a tough fucking month to work with the public. And I really feel for all the friends of DeSoto out there whose job it is to do that. It's hard. It's hard when your behavior is legislated to such a degree. And I think if you're a friend of DeSoto that is not a retail employee, you have an opportunity to bring a little light to them in a hard time.
Yeah. Shout out to everyone that's got a tough job this time of year. I know that is a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Wow, I didn't expect that intro to get that heavy, but it did.
Yeah. These are some intense Star Trek cards, man. Whoa.
Yeah, but kind of an intense episode today also. So I think kind of thematically related to our Marin is the 19th episode of season 5 of Deep Space Nine. It's called Ties of Blood and Water.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No. Of course you don't.
It's a tie you can't really give a foreign hand to. These aren't real ties.
No. Yeah,
these are family ties.
These are clip-on family ties.
The Alex P. Keaton of Deep Space Nine, of course, is Major Kira, right?
Oh, man, that just went over my head.
From Family Ties, the show. See, that's a moment where our age disparity...
That really,
really
is.
Comes to the fore. Like, it's not too many years, but those are crucial years.
I definitely feel like I caught some episodes of that show, but is that the one with Kirk Cameron on it?
No, you're thinking of Growing Pains. Family Ties was with
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox and Meredith Baxter Burney, I think.
Wow.
And these are just from the top of my head. Who's the guy? Michael Gross. Michael Gross is the guy.
Damn. And it had the font of all family television shows of that era.
It did. Yeah. It had the family serifs. I can't remember how many years I've been married to my wife, but I could remember Michael Gross and Meredith Baxter Burney. Fuck me.
Wow.
I'm such a... God, I'm so fucking dumb.
I have an easier time with that because I got married to my wife on July 11th, the same year that the Beyonce song 7-Eleven came out. And so... We played that song at our reception, and if I ever need to look it up, I can just look up the song 7-Eleven and remember.
You know, there's a kind of brain trauma where the patient can only remember things from a certain span of time and then nothing after.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that happened to me. I'm not making a joke or making light of this. Like, I'm wondering if I had like a very minor stroke and... It has just made things over the last 10 years more difficult to remember than anything in my first 20.
You know, I often wonder that working with you day in, day out.
Yeah, it's concerning. Well, speaking of scary medical diagnoses, that's what this episode is about.
Yeah, Takeni Gamor is visiting the station, and Kira is putting together a little welcoming party for him in the hallway on Deep Space Nine. She would like Dax and Worf to treat Takeni as a visiting head of state.
I think we have a red carpet in storage somewhere.
As though that is the level of importance that he carries. And you might be wondering, who is Takeni Gamor?
You and I both remember Takeni Gamor from, God, how many seasons ago was that? The episode where Major Kira was put into Cardassian loaf and made to believe that she was his daughter.
What was that episode called? Face of the Enemy? No, that's the one where Deanna Troi is in Romulan loaf.
In Deep Loaf. That's what it should have been called.
So gather round as I run it down and unravel my pedigree.
That was a fairly traumatic episode for Kira, and it was one that ended... with a very paternal relationship, a paternal feeling relationship between Takeni Gamor and Kira, and then we never heard from him again until now.
Second Skin is the name of the episode. It was season 3, episode 5.
One of the few episodes named after condoms.
Yeah. Indeed. That and Magnum are the two.
Right. I mean, we haven't seen the Star Trek Enterprise episode Special Tingle yet, but
yeah.
We may never get there.
Or the Voyager episode Ribbed for Her Pleasure.
Yeah.
Which is just an episode about the crew doing bits for Captain Janeway.
Many people dislike Star Trek Discovery for the episode Lambskin.
The case that is made, the retcon that is made in this episode, is that Kira and Gamor stayed in very close contact and have a relationship akin to a father-daughter relationship.
He's practically your father.
Your father?
Yeah. It's
like a father-daughter relationship where they live in different cities and only communicate over the phone and like don't see each other on holidays, but a lot of warmth nonetheless.
A ton of warmth. Kira is psyched that he's here, so much so that she's giving him the Riker treatment of walking him around the station, taking him to his cabin, showing him where the thermostat and the light switches are.
Yeah.
She's psyched. And her energy is in relative opposition to his fatigue. He is beat from his trip. But, you know, Kira is... psyched that he's there for a lot of reasons, one of which is that she feels like he would be interested in participating in opposing the Cardassian regime.
Yeah.
Politically.
There is no one better qualified to lead the opposition.
She's suggesting that they turn Deep Space Nine into sort of a World War II London. And
yeah,
he set up a government in exile so that he can run sort of a resistance within the Cardassian Empire while the Dominion is in charge.
That would mean that the Gul Dukat administration is kind of a Vichy Cardassia, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're cucking for the Dominion.
And she's trying to make a General Chirac out of Gamorre. And he's like, I just don't think that kind of hat is very flattering on me.
What Gul Dukat does is a war crime. I am too tired to resist, though.
I'm going to calm down for the rest of the film and just hang out in this chair and not freak out the other people in the theater.
I have a terminal illness.
Don't you feel bad for me?
Yerim Fell syndrome is what T'Keni Gamorre's got, and it's fatal.
Yeah.
It's fatal because Bashir tells us so in the infirmary. There's not much he can do. I wonder if lobotomy's on the table, though, because if you've got a terminal illness, I mean, why not, right?
Why not? Well, we offer lobotomy as a free upgrade to all services that we charge for here at the clinic.
Bashir pushes in that tape again, the now well-worn Kern tape.
If you are watching this, you have been pitched on the idea of having your memory erased.
I am Kern, compensated endorser.
Or am I? I'll never know.
Yeah, sad times.
And speaking of sad times, Gamorre is still looking for the daughter that he thought Kira was all these years later. And she's still not been found. And you know, there's some discussion of this, like, you know, if indeed she is still alive, she's been in deep cover for more than 10 years. And that is not the easiest kind of person to flush out.
No, not at all.
In addition to not wanting the hat, he also does not want the gig of being head of the government in exile, despite being a, you know, former legate, like a very powerful voice in the Cardassian body politic.
I never took his power seriously because of his costuming. He sort of came off as a sweater legate to me, right? Like, he's not wearing the body armor of the legates that we've seen before.
Yeah,
he's got, like, knitwear.
A little Donegal tweed in there. He's he looks hella retired in this getup.
You can't be a legate in tweed. I think that's what we're getting at.
Definitely. He knows his diagnosis, but they rush him to the infirmary when he explains this to Kira, and we get a little like Dr. Bashir explaining the issue to us, the audience, scene that Gamorre is very kind to treat as though it's news to him. Like, oh, interesting. Well, so what's the prognosis? he knows.
He knows, and he's always known.
Yeah. I guess it's good to get a second opinion. Good to get an opinion of a doctor that isn't the same species as you and probably never studied your species.
How much time do I have left?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, good call.
Gul Dukat.
So,
any episode about the Cardassians has to feature Gul Dukat, and he is on the scene in short order in the form of a FaceTime he has with Sisko in his office. He wants T'Keni Gamorre extradited back to Cardassia, but since there's no recognition of the Gul Dukat government, it's like what Sisko sort of laughs in the face of this request.
Yeah.
It can't be taken seriously.
He says we'll give it some consideration with his tongue so far in his cheek that it looks like he's doing that blowjob move where you like poke your tongue into your cheek to simulate the dick.
That's what that tongue is doing.
Yeah.
The tongue is the dick.
I like the framing on the FaceTime, like it's Gul Dukat's MacBook on his desk and it's kind of it's kind of shooting up, so you can see one Cardassian and one Jem'Hadar guard, like
it's great.
Stationed on either side of him. What do you think, like, if you had like a moral conundrum and a Cardassian appeared on one shoulder and a Jem'Hadar on the other, what kind of advice do you think you'd be getting?
It's a real like triangulation of evil, like like when W used to do State of the Union and it was like child groping Dennis Hastert on his right shoulder and Dick Cheney on the left. Yeah. Like
a vowed war criminal Dick Cheney on his left.
It's like as dark as that.
There's some discussion of the fact that Dukat has kept the title Gull despite being the supreme leader of all Cardassian political considerations.
So much more hands-on than Leggett. Hmm?
It's kind of a Lieutenant Colonel Gaddafi type of deal. He thinks it kind of gives him a man of the people quality and takes an opportunity to take a shot at using the title emissary.
I think it's great political building in this scene. And I think if you're hating Gul Dukat here, it's effective character building.
Yeah.
I think this is good stuff. And it's efficient, too. This is a very short scene.
Mm-hmm.
If you know T'Keni Gamor is suffering from an illness that will kill him in fairly short order, do you hand him a baby? Because that's what Kira does with Yoshi O'Brien, who I guess she occasionally gets to babysit.
Yeah.
Hands him right over to him, and he barely has the strength to hold him very long.
What is the communicability of space syndrome?
That's a great question, too.
30 steps. It's a billion sick.
That part is unclear, and like any quote-unquote father and quote-unquote daughter, he's asking probing questions about Kira's personal life, like, whatever happened to that Shakar guy?
Yeah.
Why don't you make a baby with him?
Kira is in them blogs, Adam. The celebrity press keeps track of what Kira is up to.
That's kind of a fun reveal, I think.
That's wild.
They kind of Google each other, don't they?
Yeah. It's like the time that I was Googling myself and I wrote Benjamin R. Harrison into Google and it tried to autofill wife. And I was like, yee. People have been Googling my wife.
That's fun.
Yeah.
This is an interesting scene, Ben, because this is the family that Kira has made, right? No one in this room is related. Kira's got a dad that isn't her dad and a child that isn't her child. But everyone treats everyone else in this room like family.
Yeah. And I think Kira is... This is an episode about Kira kind of being a little bit broken in terms of when and where she expresses her affection for someone. And I think she's like maybe a little bit uncomfortable in this moment because he says that like as a dying man, he wants to do this Cardassian death rite with her, which is the passing on of all of the dirty secrets that you know.
He wants to Magnolia her, I guess.
It's been such a long time since I've seen that movie. I have no idea what that means.
Just like deathbed confession.
Oh, okay.
That kind of deal.
Yeah. It's that.
Low key, they make a pretty direct comparison between young Yoshi O'Brien's comfort in the exploding electrical pit of Ops and Kira's arms.
Yeah.
Like, because you don't hear a peep out of young Yoshi here.
Yeah. All of the bits about Yoshi being incapable of chilling out when not in O'Brien or Worf's arms in the last episode. Non-canonical.
Right.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A bucket.
A pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my instinct. I don't use the bucket anymore.
So Kira meets with Sisko about this ritual. She has some doubts about whether or not she wants to do this. Doubts that Sisko recognizes, but ultimately encourages her to set aside. And this scene is blocked very interestingly. This is another Avery Brooks directed episode, and they really work the depth of field here, and in a way that really serves Kira's character. For most of this scene, it is Sisko who is in soft focus, but we're racking back and forth between the two on the focus ring as they talk, and it's really elegantly done.
It's a really cool technique because she's kind of pacing like toward and away from the camera in front of his desk. He's behind the desk in the background.
Yeah.
And whenever she turns around, they are somehow crashing the focus back to him.
Yeah.
But when she's facing the camera, which is most of the scene, the camera is much more interested in her. And that means he will occasionally have three or four lines come out of his mouth where he is just a smudge in the background because the camera is close up on her face.
Just to give a little more context to this technique, I mean, what you have here is someone running the camera, and then you have marks on the lens that a focus puller is using to go back and forth with. So you're taking a measurement between where Avery Brooks is, marking that on the lens, and then you're measuring the distance that the Navizator is from the lens, and you're marking that.
Right.
And your assistant camera, if you're lucky enough to have one, I'm guessing that they use an AC here. Like, you've got a camera, you've got a cam op, and then you've got an AC racking the focus, and then you're working back and forth. And if an actor steps out of their mark, I mean, this is a fairly long unbroken scene, so we're racking back and forth, I think, between 4 and 6 times.
Yeah.
If you miss one of those, you got to go back to one and do it again. And that's what makes a sequence like this so challenging. Like, you need to nail it every time on the focus.
There's a lot of teamwork involved, and I think Nana Visitor is an accomplished enough actor from a technical standpoint that she is, I imagine, nailing her mark each time. Like,
right.
You don't see her like looking for the spike tape on the floor, but like when she gets to the point in the conversation that they've planned ahead will be, you know, where she's standing on mark X. Like,
yeah.
The focus puller has something on the lens barrel or something on the follow focus that is marked for that spot in the scene.
And that's a tough job because the focus puller has got to both be paying attention to the dialogue and also the mark on the lens. Like,
right.
There's a lot going on for that person too.
It's very technically challenging to make this work. And
right.
It's not even always the right thing to do. Like the way this scene is blocked is extremely married to the content of the scene.
Avery Brooks is one of those directors though, that is like, uniquely interested in an actor's performance and gives an actor like Nana Visitor like a moment to shine like that without cutting away. So a sequence like this is flashy, I feel like, for an Avery Brooks as a director, but it also serves his major goal, which is making an actor shine.
Right. She's definitely the thing that you notice the most about the scene.
Right.
You know, the weight of this Cardassian death rite is really on her shoulders because it has caused her to think about her own father, her real father, who we actually meet in this flashback that we go to.
Yeah.
Father, can you hear me?
We get some familiar faces from the Resistance, and they're in the Star Trek caves, and Kira's dad is brought in on a gurney, and he's been shot in the belly. This is the long hair edition, Resistance Kira. And he's like coughing up blood and he's trying to sell her Western wear.
Y'all sell socks?
Just white.
Is there a Resistance Kira action figure?
Oh, I don't know. But the actor playing Kira Taban is Thomas Kopachi, who is a Star Trek that guy for sure, but also the sales clerk in the Western wear store in No Country for Old Men.
I love him so much.
Yeah.
But there's Laramie's working out for you.
That guy's great.
Love him a ton.
Yeah.
Ben, what is the downside to Kira, you know, sitting down for this thing with T'Keni Gamor?
Are you asking why she would be conflicted about it?
Yes, I am. Because I think the episode tells you that it's just that it's because of her unresolved feelings about the death of her own father. But there's none of that in her conversation with Sisko. Like, yeah. This is stuff that she keeps to herself.
I think that it lets you draw your own conclusions about that, but my feeling was that the relationship she has with Gamora is so father-daughter adjacent that I thought it might be partly that she feels like she has sort of erased her own father and replaced him with Gamora. Yeah. And that, like, the specter of his death has kind of provoked some feelings of guilt in her about that fact. And
it's interesting that she would ask advice from someone that she's also not giving all of that information to.
Right.
That feels like a little bit of a cheat.
Yeah, but also realistic, because I don't know that she has, like, in the same way that the episode doesn't totally define her misgivings, I don't know that she has to herself yet. Like, I think that it all is pretty well defined by the climax of the episode, but
God, you know what? That makes it so much better. Like in asking the question, I'm saying that I'm unsatisfied with her reasonings in the moment, but your answer is like, she's working it out and processing it. She doesn't know right now. And that's so much more satisfying than the idea of her having a fully formed and articulate idea for her misgivings.
Right. Like,
at this moment in time,
she feels misgivings and doesn't even know why yet. And
yeah,
that was sort of how I read it, but
that's a better read than mine.
I was ready to
poke holes in it.
Your read is valid, I think. Like, there's definitely a way to look at this and say, like, this conflict isn't actually in the script and they're just relying on her performance to get it across.
There's something confidential in that scene with Kira and Sisko that made me, that like, felt superficial.
Right. I wonder if that's partly because of some of the storytelling techniques that Star Trek occasionally uses. Like, sometimes you'll have a character flash into something like this and it's not a memory. They've, like, gone back in time, and suddenly we have to, like, deal with the fact that they've gone back in time.
Yeah.
And so you might just be, like, speculating about what this could mean for too long to get that it's just her having a quick
That's
memory.
Fair. Yeah.
I don't know. Anyways, Gamora has gone from being like a tired guy, but a man who's on his feet and holding babies and stuff, to a man who is on hospice care and passed out on a bio bed in the infirmary.
Kira's like, I really shouldn't have handed him my baby. That was a close call.
That was a mistake.
They really gave him the Starfleet Craftmatic adjustable bed.
Yeah. It's like a combination, right? Because they still give him the triangle pillow, which is nice. You know, that's probably the kind of pillow he's used to as a Cardassian.
You know what? This is costuming kind of wagging the story dog a little bit, because if they had given him the Leggett armor, he wouldn't have been comfortable in this bed like he is wearing the tweed.
Yeah, I wonder if they ever thought of having him show up in the armor and then change into the tweed.
I kind of like that visually.
Yeah, that would have been
a way to tell that story.
Yeah, like a little bit more of a bright line between him being well enough to be on his feet and being in this bed.
Yeah.
I can't go out. I'm sick.
Boo, you whore.
What are you doing? What are you doing now?
There's a crash course in caring for somebody on hospice that Bashir gives to Kira. And then we are into the tea spilling ceremony.
It seems like you've got things from here. I'm going to go play some darts.
I'm going to go drink 4 or 5 ales with Miles and then perhaps shoot down some jerrys over the English Channel. Anyways, ta-ta.
Do you think an Arnold Palmer for Dr. Bashir is half ale, half piss?
Yes. That's like a Rattler, right?
Yeah.
If it's ale and piss.
Yeah. I like a Rattler. I don't want to paint a Rattler with that brush.
I like an Arnold Palmer, so I don't want you to paint that with that brush.
Yeah.
Anyways, the tea that he is spilling is about, you know, who Gul Dukat's political enemies are and like what motivates them and stuff.
Spill it, girl. Spill it.
The discussion has been had that this is like a great come up for Starfleet intelligence. Like everybody is going to like having this information. But as Gamor goes through this, Kira flashes back once again to her days in the final moments of her father's life, and he's on the cot. He's struggling against the pain of his injury and talking about what brutal assholes the Cardassians are, how they burned their garden, set fire to their town.
I tried to talk to them, to reason with them. Look what they've done to me.
You never burn a Bajoran's garden. That's the last straw.
Yeah, like the only thing worse than that would be blowing up their pizza oven, right?
Right, yeah. Very strong feelings about pizza and gardens.
Yeah. For people that have as many beautiful pizza ovens as they have, they never make pizza. You always see them eating hasperat, never pizza.
Yeah. I don't understand it.
Do you think Bajorans go for a thin crust? Or like a breadier pizza? Or do they do like a deep dish?
If I had to guess, if Bajorans are Chicago style or thin crust, I think I'm going to guess thin crust.
Yeah, because they have like spring wine and I feel like their food is pretty light.
I feel the same way. I feel like Cardassians are heavy food people.
Yeah, yeah. Meat and potato Cardassians and more like Mediterranean
right.
Bajorans.
Yeah.
I'm going to make them pay for this, I promise you.
So these interviews are given to us in kind of montage form. We never hear a story beginning to end.
Yeah.
From Gamor, it's really like these flashes and snippets of things he was involved in.
The information is not actually like germane for our purposes.
No, not at all. Which is nice if you're a writer.
It's just that there is a great volume to it. And Sisko is like psyched. You know, like on
you mostly see it on Kira's face, like that. It's hard to get a grasp of time passing just by listening to him talk. How you experience it is through Kira, who's growing more and more fatigued by going through it.
And she says like she's been up for 30 hours, which is not really like the way of people who are on death's door in my experience.
Like, yeah,
when my uncle was dying a couple of years ago, like you would get like 15 minutes at a time and then he would like drift off to sleep for a while.
I mean, we know Kira cares for this guy a lot, but a part of her has to be wanting to grab that triangular pillow to give him a good smother. Right?
What's one more Cardassian body to her?
Yeah, that barely moves the needle.
She's working round the clock to gather this intel and also unburden him of all his secrets. We get a great shot of a super tick pulling up to Deep Space Nine. And Sisko gets up to the ops section on the elevator and he's like, what's going on?
Status report.
And they're like, oh, yeah, actually super tick just pulled up. Like when he walks into ops and says status report, how often is that the answer?
The super tick is so large and it's coming from Cardassia, like they saw it coming, right?
Right. The, like it being within weapons range should not be a surprise to everyone.
This is what long range sensors are for.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
Although after some of the dirty tricks of the Dominion takeover of Cardassia,
yeah,
you could forgive them for not always believing their sensor readings, I guess.
Dukat's there because he's like, so about that request.
You said you would give it some consideration. I was really excited to hear that. And just following up on that.
Yeah, it's great. And so it's he and Weyoun who have transported over to the station and they take a meeting in Sisko's office. This is a great Weyoun episode, I think.
Yeah.
He just seems like he is involved. Big time. You know he's pulling the strings on Ducat, but he is playing it as though he's totally detached and kind of watching things happen around him with a level of bemusement that is a lot of fun.
Like, he doesn't actually give a shit how any of it resolves.
Yeah, and even Sisko's like, I watched you die, man. Why are you here? And he's like, no, I mean, I've been cloned 5 times. It's actually not a big deal to die if you're me.
Yeah.
And it's put that casually.
It tends to mitigate the risk involved in so much of our work.
I don't think that we had that information about the Vorta up until now, but it means that any Vorta we've met, we could meet again.
It's sort of that technology where, you know, in a bar fight, the person you want to be concerned about is the one that is not the one staring super scarily at you. It's the one that's like cool and casual. That is the one you need to worry about because they've been through it a billion times.
Right.
And it's not scary to them.
Yeah.
That's what Wei Yun is like. He's so casual, he's scary.
Everything is water off a duck's back to him.
Yeah, when there are no stakes to a person, that makes them totally free.
Freedom costs a buck of fair.
So Ducat is basically saying like, hey, we are really interested in extraditing Gamor. And by extraditing, I mean inviting him to retire to the comfort of Cardassia because we have a whole new system of jurisprudence on Cardassia introduced by the Dominion. And, you know, like true to their reputation as fair and reasonable people, our new justice system has big improvements and has cleared Gamor's name entirely.
This whole situation has cured the Yarumfell syndrome because in this scene, Takeni Gamor is full of vim and vigor.
Man,
he's pissed.
That's so weird. I literally have a note that says Gamor suddenly full of vim when Ducat shows up.
Yeah, he's cured.
We both use the term vim.
Yeah.
He was very vigorous, Father.
Yeah, in a way that has to kind of low-key irritate Bashir a little bit because he's filling him full of drugs and none of the drugs have worked as good as Ducat.
No, yeah, Ducat is a real panacea.
Ducat, only with a prescription.
Common side effects of Ducat include sleeplessness, headache, fatigue, dry mouth, strained muscles from eye rolling, stomach ache, nausea, vomiting, pubic lice, strained trapezius, swelling, redness, grayness, fecal popcorning, despotism, despondency, diarrhea, bloating, belching, felching. If you have an erection that lasts longer than 4 hours, seek immediate medical help.
That makes the price too high.
Ask your doctor if Ducat is right for you.
Gamor is not interested in playing this kind of ball with them, even when the idea of his daughter is produced by Ducat. Like, not even that is interesting enough for him to play ball because Gamor knows he's going to be dead soon.
Yeah.
So he turns them down.
Morn. Morn.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
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 You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
We get another little montage of Kira taking care of him and taking his confession. And then an exhausted moment of Kira in Quark's bar, where Quark is offering her a long list of beverages, and she's basically just ignoring him until he offers to bring her like a glass of warm milk.
Yeah, Quark does that pivot where he's initially a dick,
yeah,
and then finally does something nice.
It's these moments that, like, you know, Quark is playing into his own self-image and then reveals that he has a heart.
You look terrible. Not that I mind. I like my women a little rumpled.
I feel like half the writer's room really want that to be the deal with Quark, is that he talks a big game about being a terrible person, but in reality has a heart of gold. And the other half the writer's room is like, no, he's just a terrible person.
Yeah, you really do feel that tension. They're trying to figure out like what the line is for lovable scoundrel.
Right.
What's the limit there?
Yeah.
I don't think we know.
I don't know either. Kira passes out in her apartment and is awakened by Ducat kind of barging in. And he's trying to make the same pitch to her that he did originally to Gamor. Like, you know, maybe try and talk him into coming back with us. And she's like, hey, why don't you fuck off? And he's like, well, like, you know, there's some things about him that you might not realize. Like, for example, Kiesa Monastery. Have you ever considered what role he might have played in that? She's like, oh, that
historical massacre that was very terrible. And he was like, yes, I'll just leave this right here. And he sets an iPad down on her table and walks out of the room.
She fucking nails him with a teacup like that police chief in The Big Lebowski.
Ow! Fucking fascist!
I couldn't tell if she hit him or the wall just behind him. Because he, like, his head moves so quickly that I couldn't tell if it, like, actually was supposed to connect with his face.
I think his head goes back and to the left to the extent that I think he sells the idea that he was hit with it.
Wow.
It's a great scene. I love how Kira shifts gears in the span of 10 seconds. She is sarcastic and biting and then fucking angry.
I would love to see somebody just go through this frame by frame and see if we can get to the bottom of whether this actually lands.
Yeah.
Because teacup as a missile is a pretty intense move.
Yeah.
And very Kira. Like, nice to see her in her pizza oven destroying shirt for this moment.
Yeah, it's the right garment for the moment. Kira can't help but read this report, and then she confronts Gamor in the next scene about this massacre. And he admits to it and also says that it was war and he was young. But that does not satisfy Kira. She is pissed.
Yeah, pissed to the extent that she doesn't think she can forgive him for having been a part of it.
The more I learn about that guy, the more I don't care for him.
And he's like, listen, if I could go back to before my frontal lobe had developed and not enlisted in the Cardassian military and not, like, volunteered for service on Bajor, I would. But here I am, like a dying old man full of regrets, and I'm telling you, like, that's not me now. And yeah. She's like, fuck you, and storms out of the room.
Yeah.
I didn't want you to hate me.
It's what you deserve.
We get a fun interstitial scene at Quark's where Weyoun is enjoying Dabo, and Sisko invites he and Gul Dukat to have some canard with him at a table nearby.
Not the friendliest invitation, because Sisko only has one glass, which means they're not going to be drinking together. He's just pouring a glass for Gul Dukat. And he shoves this glass over at him, and Gul Dukat is like, no, I never drink that stuff before 5 p.m. or whatever.
You drinking the witch after dinner? No class.
Despite the fact that he's got, like, a great big champagne flute in his hand.
It ends up that the bottle of canard has been poisoned because the station received a shipment of poison bottles of canard for Gamor. And my question for you is, would Sisko have allowed Gul Dukat to drink from that bottle? How far would he have allowed this to go?
Wow. Yeah. Like, how does it look on your service record when, as captain of Deep Space Nine, you poured a glass of poison for the head of a hostile alien government?
It's he almost Princess Bride's Gul Dukat here, right?
Yeah.
They walk right up to that moment, but they don't really go all the way.
Are there rocks ahead?
If they are, they all be dead.
Gul Dukat never admits anything, but then Weyoun is, like, having such fun that he reaches for the glass, chugs it to the dome.
Oh my, that is quite toxic, isn't it?
Look, man, we know the Dominion are bad people, but I aspire to live my life with the way that Weyoun is.
Yeah.
He is having the most fun in this episode.
He really is. This is like Weyoun in this episode is like me at our recent Boston live show where you abandoned me on stage to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I chugged all of the wine that was left on stage, which was like kind of a lot.
You sure did. I came back to nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing to drink.
I was a mess after that.
Yeah. You sure were. You gave the people what they wanted.
You really want to do this here, now? Okay, let's do it!
You know who else is a mess, Adam? Is Major Kira. Such a mess that she has to go to Temple and see if she can get some comfort from the prophets. And I don't think she really can. But Odo is there to almost taunt her when she comes out.
You got something to say to me, Constable? Say it.
Like, I don't know if he's pursuing a new strategy in his attempt to woo her, but, like, negging somebody who is having a spiritual crisis is probably not the best way to cause them to land in your arms.
I don't get this angle by him. This feels like Odo Ex Machina a little bit. I don't understand his motivation for encouraging Kira to forgive. Like, Odo lived on that station a long, long time under the thumb of evil Cardassians, and it's not like Odo has come to grips with that experience in a way that has allowed him to forgive the many things that happened during wartime. Like, has he had his epiphany on screen, to our knowledge?
I don't know. His argument is that Gamora was 19 when this massacre went down, so, like, he can't have been senior enough to have ordered it, and we don't know the extent to which he was a willing participant.
And he was young, dumb, and full of canard.
Right. I don't know. Like, he's sort of arguing, like, war makes people of all kinds make pretty terrible decisions. And that's sort of, like, meant to imply that perhaps Major Kira made some terrible decisions of her own when she was in the Resistance.
Regards.
Thus provoking another flashback. And this one is the one where her dad is really in the throes of suffering from his phaser wound. And instead of, like, being there with him for these last moments of his life, she like gets together a crew of Resistance fighters to go hoo-ride on some Cardassians for Rewenge.
What does it mean?
It means omerta. It means Rewenge.
And by the time she gets back, her father's died in her absence.
Right. And this is where I think the rubber meets the road for my theory about why these memories are coming up and complicating her feelings about Gamora, is that the guilt of having missed that has weighed on her forever, and now she has a very compelling reason to ignore and disconnect from Gamora, but he's kind of an opportunity to seek some redemption for her past sins.
Bashir really applies the leverage to the situation by saying no one should have to die alone in encouraging Kira to be at his bedside. Why does this get said as often as it does? Ben, you hear all the time about people close to death will have family members at their bedside like almost 24/7. And like the moment they leave to go get coffee, like in that 5-minute span, the relative will have died.
They, like, do you saw think that the coast true? Was clear and they snuck out?
No, I mean, you know what I mean, right? Like it, almost like an instinct to a human being is to die alone, almost.
It's definitely an instinct to animals, right? Like,
yeah,
your cat sneaks off and passes away or whatever.
I wonder why we've all agreed to this being the truth, because it sure seems like there's evidence to the contrary, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's just about comfort for the remaining people, right? That's why we say it, because we need something to do as those that will live on, right?
Yeah. You can't take it with you, Adam.
Sure can't.
I think that the other part of this episode that is unspoken is the way that Kira has kind of worked her way back toward being friends with Odo, despite this stuff that she knows about how he comported himself under Cardassian rule.
Yeah.
If she can come around on Odo, she can possibly come around on Gamora. And in the wake of remembering, like, returning to her Resistance caves and finding that her dad passed away, she comes back and sits at Gamora's bedside as he shuffles loose this mortal coil. And it's like we don't actually see the moment of his passing. We get a very long monologue from her just talking to Dr. Bashir in the infirmary about what those last moments between her and Gamora were like.
It's an example of telling and not showing that actually works in telling's favor when you've got Nana Visitor doing the lines.
Yep.
It's better this way.
It's better this way. It's like the camera doesn't cut away that much. It's mostly done in a pretty close single on her. And, it, you know, once or twice, you know, she'll glance at Bashir and it'll give us a Bashir reacts. But, you know, there's not much to that side of the story. Like, mostly this is a tearful description of the death of a father figure. And she's, you know, she's feeling it in that way.
I think it's crucial that she does not achieve catharsis. You know, like, this doesn't fix the situation she had with her real father. It's just as painful to go through the death of someone close to her this time around.
Right. It doesn't undo what happened between her and her biological father.
Right. She's pretty shattered.
And Bashir, to his credit, says a few comforting words, but, you know, it's one of those things that is not, you know, you're not that able to be comforted in a moment like this. And
also, I feel like that would be out of character for him to try. Like, he treats the moment fairly administrative. I mean, he's supportive of her, but he's not going to sit next to her and hold her.
Right.
That's just not his way.
I thought a lot about that, like the fact that this is a couple, like in real life in this moment.
Wow. Yeah.
And like,
that's true.
The level of emotion that they're going through. I wonder if as actors who have embarked on a relationship with each other, they do some aftercare after a scene like this.
I wonder how hard Alexander Siddig struggled against his own, like, he's seeing his wife experience this trauma in front of him. There's something inside you that I feel like is
right.
Instinctually trying to reach out and help in a way that your character can't. And that's got to be such a struggle.
When you're accessing feelings like the ones that Nana Visitor is accessing in this scene, like, the feelings are real while you're bringing them up. Like,
right.
Even if it's for a fictional reason, like, the, you know, like it's you're running a simulation of having that experience and it has the same like physical ramifications in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So tough.
The button on the episode is in the aftermath, Dukat and Weyoun meet up with Sisko in his office and they've heard about Gamora's death. Gul Dukat is like, "You killed T'Keni. You bastards."
Oh my God.
Dukat is going to use this moment for his own ends. He's like, "I'm going to go back to Cardassia and tell everyone that on his deathbed, Gamora supports the Dominion."
Right.
And there's really not anything Sisko can do about it.
Well, the one thing that he can do is withhold the body, right? Because,
yeah,
like, Dukat wants to make some political theater of a, you know, like, full military honors as and a, you know, prime time state funeral for, yeah, Gamora, and that is not the burial that Gamora is going to get. Instead, it is a very private funeral service for one.
Yeah, at a grave that Kira digs herself on Bajor, and it's a plot right next to her real father. We know this because it's that same tree that we saw in the flashback where she buried her father before.
Yeah, but it's a different season. The scene is very lush in a way that it was not in the flashback. And I guess that's also like sort of metaphorical for how far Bajor has come since the Resistance era.
God, Kira digs a great looking grave.
Yeah.
It is like
clean.
A Japanese garden style, like, pattern in the dirt.
Yeah.
Really well done.
Very nice. She gives great grave.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the note we end on. Did you like the episode, Ben?
I did. I think that I had a little problem with how retconny the relationship felt between Kira and Gamor, and how I didn't quite get man who's about to be on death's door from him when he first showed up.
Mm.
Like, I was like, oh yeah.
Like he didn't cough into a handkerchief and look at it and there's like a red spot.
Right. Like tired from a flight proceeding to, you know, on a gurney with an IV in 5 minutes time, felt very sudden to me. And that was a struggle for me with this episode. But any episode that gives Major Kira a big emotional arc to go through is always going to be satisfying, because you've got an incredibly capable actor delivering that experience. And all of the emotion of that was really real to me and really well drawn.
So if we reshoot the scene where Takeni Gamor arrives on the station, and instead of wanting to go to his quarters for a nap, he kind of staggers into Worf and Dax's arms. Is that a more effective way to begin his illness story?
I think you need something like that, like something like the transport is coming in. They're expecting him, but they get word ahead of time that there's been a medical emergency in flight, and like they're going to need to like get him right to the infirmary or something, you know, something like that. And then also like two episodes in between seasons 3, episode 5, and season 5, episode 19, continuing the idea that she and Gamor are dear to each other.
Yeah, they almost cop to the idea that they're not writing each other and they're not doing FaceTime. They're just Google snooping each other. Yeah.
Which is a bad way to maintain a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, there are some holes here, as you say. But, I mean, give me Avery Brooks directing The Nah Visitor, and that's all I need, I think. She gets two centerpiece scenes all to herself, basically. And that makes for a good episode in my book. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages?
Yeah.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental
income? Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of Priority One messages here. The first one is from Yoli, and it's to Sam. Goes like this. Shmooly, we're getting married. Or maybe we already got married, depending on when Ben and Adam read this. I'm spending $138 Canadian just to tell you that you're my heartbeat. Your pa is strong. I'm down for some Jamaharon. You better watch out. As Vic Fontaine says, the best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Wow.
Really calling a shot with who's coming and when, huh?
Yeah. Congratulations on your impending and or recent nuptials, Shmooly and Yoli.
That's great. Making it work.
Yeah.
See, it's not all bad out there.
I love that.
Yeah. Ben, our second Priority One message comes from
Clayton!
And it's for
Nicole!
I'm saying it that way because both of those names have exclamation points.
Oh, yeah.
The message goes like this. I love you, Nicole! And we both love this podcast! See, there's exclamation points throughout. I'm trying to give it that read.
Do you think that exclamation points are the same thing as all caps?
Oh, is that what I'm doing? Am I doing a bad read?
I don't know. I'm scratching my head here because I've never screamed at a sentence that has an exclamation point at the end.
You know what? I'm going to take it down to a 7. I think. Okay. Like in reading this message, I think that's the sincerity it's asking for.
Okay.
Well, here we go. I'm going to start over, right?
Okay. Yeah. Take your time.
I love you, Nicole. And we both love this podcast. We're probably listening to it right now. Ben and Adam are really funny. And you, Nicole, are the best. Merry Christmas. Happy birthday. Or happy just whatever day this comes out.
Wow.
I love you so much. You're the best wife. Also, thanks Ben and Adam for doing the show and reading my message. Big fan.
Wow. I had thought previously that my wife was the best wife, but it turns out Nicole is the best wife.
Yeah, that's it. Clayton really showed us.
Jeez.
Kind of threw it in our faces, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. I feel a little bit wife-shamed.
Wow. Yeah, pretty rough. It would be our way to experience the joy of another person's relationship as an attack on our own.
Yeah. Well, Nicole and Clayton, it sounds like you two also found great people to be betrothed to. Couple of happy couples in the pew on section today, Adam. If you'd like to declare your undying love for someone out there, you know what to do. You head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And they are both great ways to support the production of this program.
Gotta get that gold press latch. Get that
gold press latch.
Am I right? Woo! Yeah! Am I right?
Put your best foot forward and present your new business project or political thing as well as you possibly can on the internet. How do you do that? Not through some cookie cutter form on a social media website or trying and failing to code a pretty website yourself. No, you go to Squarespace, start using their completely new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, which helps you choose from professionally curated layouts and styling options that help you build a unique online presence from the ground up that is tailored to your brand or business. Squarespace has been a super loyal sponsor of The Greatest Generation. We hope you will give them a try. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/scarves to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Personal grooming is less about something I do for myself, even though there are myriad reasons for that, and more about my consideration for other people who have to look at me, be around me, and on special occasions, love me physically. And when it's clear my front and back yards are becoming overgrown and unsightly, I'll break out the mower, the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra from Manscaped. This Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra is really something else. This trimmer features two interchangeable next-gen skin-safe blade heads, a standard one for taking a little off the top, a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Listen, spring cleaning doesn't just apply to your nether regions. Get the full grooming experience with Manscaped's signature Beard Hedger Pro Kit and Handyman Electric Face Shaver. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants, right?
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Gotta get that gold press latinum. Get that
gold press latinum.
Latinum.
Gold press latinum.
To our
yamak songs.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Do you find yourself a drunk Wayoon?
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I think You see my drunk Wei-Yun, who's not Wei-Yun, he's a drunk Shimoda Ben.
Oh, how delightful.
In the FaceTime that Dukat has with Sisko very early on, there's a moment where Sisko calls Dukat a Dominion puppet.
Yeah.
And the Dennis Hastert Cardassian over his right shoulder just gives a stare down to the Demhadar over his left shoulder and like locks into him for the remainder of the conversation in a way that is great. Like that is a choice that I really love.
Yeah.
Like you know what that guy's feeling, and yeah, he doesn't like to be called a puppet, that guy in the back. He takes great umbrage with that.
No puppet. No puppet. You're the puppet.
Yeah. What about you, Ben?
It's Wei-Yun.
Yeah. I mean, for drinking poison.
Speaking of working the puppet, you could just, he's fucking elbow deep in Dukat this whole episode.
Yeah.
But also clearly doesn't really care what happens with any of this. Like, it's kind of immaterial to him. He's kind of humoring Dukat in this moment. And definitely the character that's having the most fun in the episode.
The stakes for, it's weird that everyone else is experiencing extremely high stakes except for Wei-Yun.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Like this episode would work if they hadn't written him back into it. Like, we wouldn't be like, I feel like there was something missing without him.
Yeah.
But he adds to it.
I hope we get a lot more Wei-Yun in the seasons ahead because he adds a spice to the episodes now that I've really, like, I want that flavor more and more. I want that detached character commenting and sniping at people. Like, Wei-Yun has basically touched the Mario star. Like, he's fine. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It makes everyone look silly in proximity. Lightens the mood. Well, a couple of good Shimodas there, Ben.
Yeah. You want to talk about what we're going to be doing next and how we will be doing it?
Well, the only way to do that is for you to tell me about that episode and then for both of us to consult the Game of Buttholes, Will of the Prophets.
Yeah, that's true. Well, the next episode is Season 5, Episode 20, Ferengi Love Songs. Another Quark episode, Adam. Quark sacrifices his mother's happiness in order to regain his standing in Ferengi society.
The return of Moogie.
Yeah.
Currently, our little runabout is pulsing on square 57, where several squares ahead, we've got a space butthole that would drop us all the way down to square 18. That would be quite a tumble.
That would.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Let's see if we hit it. Oh, I hit it.
Whoa, shit.
We are all the way back down to square 18.
Drink is the antidote.
Wow.
Quark's bar episode.
Yeah.
God damn.
How about that? We are going to, boy, not quite start the new year doing a Quark's bar. We're going to do Quark's bar, then New Year's Eve.
Wow.
Is how Greatest Gen is going to go into the year 2020.
We're gonna wake up in the new year with a bad hangover, I predict. Yeah.
Take your brode.
Fuck.
Yeah. Well, we want to wish a happy new year and a happy holiday season to a lot of friends of DeSoto. Maybe most of all, those who we unwrap the gift from every month. Those that go to MaximumFun.org/donate. They keep our show going.
Indeed. We also got to thank our buddy Bill Tilly, who makes collectible trading cards out of every episode. They delight me. Every week he puts out new trading cards using the hashtag GreatestGen on Twitter, and it is always a highlight of my week. I laugh at the funny pictures he finds from the episodes and the quotes that he pulls from our show. It's just fucking great.
Adam Ragusea is a great teacher. He's great at music because he is responsible for the music of our show using a lot of the source music material from Dark Materia. But he is also one of the finest foodsmen in the game. You think his holiday meals are pretty good this time of year? I bet they are.
Oh yeah, he's given all these turkey cooking lessons and stuff on YouTube. He's got a smash hit YouTube channel, Adam.
You know what Adam Ragusa is doing? He's putting nutmeg in the glass and then adding the eggnog. That's what he does.
We got to thank the great folks at MaximumFun.org who are all instrumental in helping us get this show out there. And thanks to everyone that leaves us a nice review on Apple Podcasts or their podcatcher of choice.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which is pre-funkin'.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.